He showed such promise when he was coming up, you know, and here we have this terrible problem.
We are back live at the Rose Garden, and we've had a couple of microphone problems, which we think we have fixed now. And so, what did you just say?
I said if you were a politician, all these mics went out, they'd say, are you a failed network? Are you a failed newscaster?
They will be saying that, maybe, in a half hour from now.
It's just one of those things. Something always goes wrong.
You know what? We need to talk about this. Travelgate. Who knew what when? And why was the FBI called in? And why did you hire your cousin? And why did you have a firm from Arkansas take over this business? And
first of all, let's get back to the beginning, okay? Let's talk about my cousin. She's about my fifth or sixth cousin who worked in the campaign and ran the travel operations. We had a very efficient travel operation. Every operation of the White House was reviewed because I said I was going to cut the White House staff by 25%. That's not easy to do. To run the White House on fewer people than your predecessor. We got more mail in 3.5 months than came to the White House in all of 1992. It's tough. We found out that there were 7 people working in the travel office, primarily to book travel for the press, and that the press was complaining that the cost was too high. So there were all these recommendations made to change it, but nothing was done until an accounting firm came in and reviewed the operation and found serious management questions in terms of unaccounted for funds and things like that. So then the person in charge of that made the decision to replace them. Now, all those questions were raised about whether they all should have been replaced. Mr. McLarty got on it. He did an internal review. He'll fix it. But the issue is, should we work 7 people when 3 can do the job? And if we save 25% off the cost of the very first plane flight, isn't that a good thing for the press? That's what we're trying to do.
And nobody's going to argue with that, but what they are going to argue with is why was the FBI called in?
Oh, the FBI, because the FBI was called in to look at the auditor's report. Not to accuse any of these people of doing anything criminal, but because there were sufficient questions raised that there had to be a review of it. And FBI sounds like a huge deal to you, but when you're in Washington, you're the president. You can't call the local police or the local prosecutor. That's who you call.
But your own attorney general is now posing the question about a breach of policy.
Well,
is she right or wrong?
Well, there has never, to the best of our ability to determine it, there has never been a policy that if the White House had a local internal matter, they had to go through the attorney general to get to the FBI. The FBI has always been an independent investigative agency. But I have no problem with doing that because I trust her. I think she's got great judgment. But the report in the auditor's findings made us believe that someone at least ought to look into this and clear the air. And that's all we were trying to do.
Was Attorney General Reno justified in questioning the process?
She can question whatever she wants to, I think. She's a fine person. I like her. But I'm just saying, to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a policy that the White House, if they had some internal activity going on here, would clear asking the FBI to look into it through the Attorney General. But I have no problem with doing it. That's not with me or anybody else was that the policy before, to the best of my knowledge.
But at minimum, it looks like you use the FBI to justify what in turn ended up looking like, or was in fact
an act of cronyism. It may look like that, but the bottom line, it wasn't an act of cronyism. The bottom line is, if we can run an office with 3 that they were taking 7 to run, and we can save 25% off a trip because we have competitive bidding when they didn't have competitive bidding, the press saves money and the taxpayers save money. That was my only objection. If anything wrong was done, Mr. McLarty will correct it. This is a do-right deal, not a do-wrong deal. Let's not obscure what happened. We are trying to do the people's work with less money.
You have a question?
Yes, I do.
Your name is?
Patrick Moore. I'm from Redwood City, California. I was a Clinton precinct leader in that state, and I'm very happy to see you elected. My question, however, is regarding the environment. I supported you in spite of the issue that Tyson is one of the major producers of jobs in your state. It's also the major producer of pollution in your state. And I supported you and hoped that Al Gore would work on convincing you to be more of an environmental president than George Bush was. However, I noticed that you recently backed down when it came to upping the user fees on mining, grazing, and lumber. This is in spite of the fact that a mining, I believe, is fixed at like under $1 an acre to mine. This based upon a post-Civil War law, but you've not upped it. I understand
$17 billion
to the budget.
No, there wasn't $17 billion, I don't think. But do y'all know what he's talking about? The federal government owns land. That's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. The federal government owns a lot of land on which there are trees, cattle, and minerals to be mined. most people believe, and it's absolutely true, that essentially people have been permitted to use that land, mostly out west, to cut trees, graze cattle, and mine minerals at lower than a market rate. Now, all the people who do that have good reasons why they think the system is good, and I don't know if we've got any of those folks in the audience, but I feel that the mining fees should be raised. Originally, he's right, we had that in our original budget, and we took it out, not to take a dive on it, but because since it's a new issue, under the parliamentary rules of the Senate, we'd be subject to a filibuster. That is, you have to get 60 votes, not a majority, to pass the budget. So we are moving now a new mining reform law through the Congress, which will do exactly what you say. We just had to agree to do it on a separate track. The mining reform is on track. I believe this year I will sign a mining reform law, which you'll be very proud of, which will require those companies to pay back to the Treasury more nearly the value of what they have gotten from the United States government, and it'll be good for the environment. It's a good question. It's going through on a separate track, and we had to break it out for parliamentary reasons because of the opposition to it in the Senate.
And we've got to take another break right now, just about 23 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with our exclusive town meeting with President Clinton in a moment. Live with a two-hour town meeting with President Clinton. Before we get back to our audience, a quick question to you about staff. There has been a lot of criticism that you've surrounded yourself by young and inexperienced people. There have been talk that maybe there are going to be some major shakeups over the next couple of days. Are you entirely satisfied with the White House staff you have in place?
No, but they're working hard and we've gotten a lot done. I'm glad I got to talk about that. I think they're always going to be. This is the hardest place in the country to work in some ways. And I think that we've had a period, you know, we came in, most of us were not from here. We were trying to do things differently. And there are a lot of things that we didn't handle as well as could have been handled as travel offices one, where what we were trying to do was good for the country and good for the taxpayers. And there were glitches in it. We are going to fix that. But I think that by and
You're
large, we
fix
have
that by firing
we
anybody?
Have a Well, just watch and see what we do. We're going to, I'm not.
No hints?
No hints. But I would also say that I wonder whether people think the staff is younger than it is. I mean, you have the head of my economic team, Bob Rubin, is in his 50s and was one of the most successful people on Wall Street. Our major senior staff, I think on balance, is slightly older than President Kennedy's were. But there are a lot of young people in other positions here, and sometimes I think that the overall impression is that the staff is quite a bit younger than it is in terms of people that are actually making the decisions.
Harry's
got a question
out here.
Question for
Your
you?
Name, please?
Elizabeth Hogg.
Where are you from?
From St. Paul, Minnesota.
Far away.
One of the big things about your campaign was hope for the future and don't stop thinking about tomorrow. My question is about the children in the country, especially in the inner cities. It seems like they've kind of lost hope, and it seems like they don't have a future, and I'm wondering what we can do as a country to instill that back into them.
I think there are some things that I can do as president, but there are also some things that are going to have to be done community by community and block by block. Let me talk about the things I can do first. My job, I think, for those kids is to try to do as much as I can to make sure they got a fair chance to make it under difficult circumstances. What does that mean? That they have a healthy beginning, get a good chance to get a head start program and decent nutrition, that their schools are as good as we can influence them, that their streets are safer, that they have a chance to work when they're young, at least with summer jobs, and that there's some economic opportunity there. We have presented initiatives in all this area. We're gonna have more police on the street, more investment in Head Start, and a dramatic increase in the incentives for business to invest in those areas. But frankly, I think also we have to say to those kids, the only way you can make it is if you play by the rules. And we know it's tougher where there aren't as many intact families. We know it's tougher where there's more violence. But we've got to have more people go in and deal with those kids one-on-one. A friend of mine said the other day, someone asked her, said, how are we going to rescue all these kids? And she said, the same way we lost them, one at a time. And we've got to have more people interested in these people as people. I'm telling you, I just got back from South Central LA. Those kids aren't all that different from everybody else's kids. They just want a chance to live. And if we can give it to them with more personal involvement, I think they can make it.
But you talk about one-on-one. Are you talking about as a giant volunteer corps? Are you talking about some kind of system that's going to cost more money to do?
No, I'm talking about...
In 30 seconds.
I'm talking about...
the money should be going to the things I mentioned. What we need is for people in
each of these communities to be involved with those kids. I can't do that. We need people in these communities sponsoring the schools, involved in the schools, working with those kids after schools and on the weekends. They're good kids. They just need a chance to make it.
All right, we'll be back with more live from the Rose Garden, the White House, right after this, 17 minutes before the hour. Washington, D.C., talking with a first real, this is the first national network town meeting since you've been elected president. We thank you for allowing us to come in. If you wouldn't mind standing up and asking your question. Your name?
My name is Eleanor Phillips. I'm from Tarzana, California. I've been going to China since 1980, 7 or 8 times. I've lived and worked in China for 2 years. I'm very concerned about what you're going to do with the
most favored nation.
On the one hand, if you don't give them this, you feel that you'll pressure the government into changing their attitude. On the other hand, the people don't want that to happen because they feel that they will be hurt financially, and then when they're hurt economically and financially, then they'll get less rights and privileges.
Is this a done deal? Your decision on this?
I think it is a done deal for the next year. Let me explain the issue here. In order for a country to trade with us, they have to get what's called most favored nation status in order to have big trade. China is a huge trading partner of ours. We have our second biggest trading deficit with China, just behind Japan. They've got one of the fastest growing economies in the world. They're moving away from communism to market economics very quickly. They still put political prisoners in jail. They still, we think, have used prison labor to make products. And we have some other problems with them. The issue is, should we revoke that or should we put conditions on it? I basically have decided to extend most favored nation status for a year because I want to support modernization in China, and it's a great opportunity for America there. But I want to make it clear to them that there has to be some progress on human rights and the use of prison labor. Our trade disputes and our disputes about arms sales, I'm going to take out of this issue and negotiate directly with them. I think they will appreciate the gesture I'm making, but I hope they understand that the United States just can't turn its back on the abuse of lots of people, and especially the use of prison labor and just choking people off when they say their piece.
Trying to work all sides of the audience over here. President Clinton, the next question.
For this woman. I'm Jen Wagner from Troy, Michigan. My question, Mr. President, when you wake up in the morning before you get out of bed, do you lie there and think, what stupid little thing's going to happen today?
Some days I do. What I really think of is stupid little things happen to everybody, and I just hope that if some stupid little thing happens to me, it wouldn't overshadow all the big good things I'm trying to do. But actually, when I get up in the morning, I say a little prayer that I won't make any stupid little mistakes and that I'll do right by America today. That's what I do. Then I go out here and run off old age, or I do my best to do that.
Here we go, Mr. President.
Good morning, Mr. President. My name is Robert Branham, and I'm president of the Bloomingdale Civic Association here in Washington, and you're welcome to come to our community at any time.
Thank you. I'd like to.
My question basically is, can you express to the American people why it is important for the District of Columbia to have statehood, to have the opportunity to vote for 2 senators and members of Congress?
Well, I think, frankly, having the senators and the members of Congress is not as important as having control over your own destiny. The District of Columbia now has more people than 5 other states, pays more taxes than 10 other states, and sent more soldiers to fight in the Persian Gulf War than 20 other states. And yet, every time they turn around, Congress can overturn anything they do through their elected officials. If they became a state, yes, it's true, they would get 2 senators and a member of Congress, just like the other small state. But the main thing is they would have more control over their own destiny. It's very frustrating for the people in the district to know that Congress can do or not do anything, just like this fellow said here, that they can, you know, say, no, you can't have $2 million for police, and they can't do it on their own because they don't have the independence. So that's why I've always supported statehood. Once I saw the facts about the size, the taxes, and the contribution to the national interest, I thought they ought to have the right to be independent.
We need to take a break. We'll come back with more live from the Rose Garden. It's 5 minutes before the hour on CBS This Morning. We are live at the White House Rose Garden with President Clinton, the first national network town. town meeting since you were elected. We appreciate you letting us come in here. We've got lots of questions from more than 200 people in the audience, Paul.
And this man's been waiting very patiently for the last hour. Please stand and you can fire away.
My name is Bill Frazier from Montana. I work for the Rural Electric. And my question for you is, with all the troubles in the world going on now, how do you like being on the bubble with your haircut?
I just learned to live with it. I think you got to learn to laugh at things like that. You know, when little things get made big and big things get made little, you know, and you make a boner, you know, I mean, I told you the truth earlier. I was really trying to avoid inconveniencing people, not trying to inconvenience people. It just winds up being embarrassing when something like that happens to you. You just have to laugh it off and go on.
Earlier this morning...
If you didn't have a sense of humor in this business, you'd be ground down to nothing pretty quick.
Earlier this morning, President Clinton, you said you would ask your aides on the plane whether this, you know, the haircut was going to cause any delays or not, and they said no. There's a piece in the Wall
Secret
Street
Service
Journal...
Said no.
This Wall Street Journal is suggesting that maybe the staff members don't have enough of a spine to stand up to you. Can you comment on that report?
They asked, the Secret Service asked, and they were told that there would be no delays. It was just a mess up. I mean, it was just a mess up.
Do you wish you hadn't gotten that haircut?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wear a $40 watch. Do I look like the kind of guy that would go and sit on an airport? And you know, I mean, it was just a blow-up. Glad they didn't find out about the manicure.
All right, here we go.
What's up? Good morning, Mr. President.
What's your name?
My name is Michelle Sprengelmeyer from East Dubuque, Illinois. Tomorrow I'm graduating from medical school, and we'll be going into... residency training and family practice. I'm graduating with over $100,000 in student loans from medical school alone. I'm wondering how you anticipate the health care reform will help me to be able to pay back my student loans, as well as the many colleagues that have a similar situation as I do.
The fear being that doctors aren't going to make as much money, and for folks like this, they're not going to be able to pay their bills, right?
First of all, don't sit down yet. I want to look at you. Only about 15% of our medical school graduates are now doing what this fine woman is doing, coming out as family practitioners. Most medical school graduates now want to be specialists, partly because they want to do it, partly because they have more control over their hours, partly because they can make more money. What we are going to try to do is to create more incentives for people to go into family practice. Easier to pay off your loans, have government-targeted assistance to medical school to lower the cost of medical education, give you more opportunities to be in family practice course to bring down the cost of your debt. And I don't think that your income will be constricted. I think there'll be more reliance on family practice, and we're going to have to do more in primary preventive medicine in America if we're ever going to bring the cost of health care down.
I have another health care related question from you from back here.
Thanks. My name is Dan Beeman. I'm from Springfield, Missouri. I'm glad to hear that answer because one of my children is in medical school and going into family health care.
That's great.
I work for a company that has less than 500 employees. I pay $50 a month for a health plan, a dental plan, life insurance. Our health plan is self-insured. I am concerned I don't want to pay more money for health care individually. I'm concerned that my employer may be taxed and have to pay more money. And I would receive less benefits than I'm receiving, as well as I want to keep my self-funded health plan. How would the change in health care, how would it affect me as an individual?
Well, let me say, first of all, one of the decisions that has not been finalized yet, at least in our original report, is to what extent any companies of any size should be able to, in effect, continue their self-insurance efforts. And that's a tough issue because what we're trying to do is to get these pools of insurance big enough for small businesses to have affordable health care, because that's been a backbreaker for a lot of small businesses. The requirement that they're working on in terms of financial contribution would not be a tax over and above what people are paying now. They're trying to hit the national average, maybe even a little below the national average of what employers are paying now. And many, many employers and employees in this country will actually save money if the health care plan comes into effect. But if you have a national budget, you have to have some sort of national standard for what the contribution will be by employers. But it's not going to be over and above what people are paying now. They're trying to substitute for it. And they're trying to work out what that number is now. But to your point of view, if you have a low-cost self-insurance plan, what we're going to try to do is to make sure that the people with low-cost plans and generous coverage don't have less coverage and higher costs. That's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is to broaden the coverage.
15 minutes after the hour, we need to take a break. We'll come back live to the Rose Garden right after
and lower
this.
The cost. I'm sorry, I didn't say.
You know, D.C., I think the president is probably hoping it's just as nice up the street a little bit and the Congress, but we've got lots of questions from our audience. Go ahead.
Mr. President, my name is Mel Streeter, and I'm an architect from Seattle, Washington. And the question I'd like to ask you is, what vision does you and your administration have for the revitalization of housing, both in the urban areas and the rural areas?
I think the housing economy, first of all, is a big part of our overall economy. My vision is that we will set in motion market forces with a little bit of government support, but not a lot, mostly market forces, which will enable us to resume a vigorous home building sector in the American economy. And let me just mention some of the things that are important to that. The most important thing is to pass a deficit reduction plan that keeps interest rates down. Interest rates, mortgage rates now are about 20-year low. Last year, only 47% of people under 35 thought they were going to be able to own their own homes. This year, about 74% do. That's because interest rates are down, because we're trying to bring the deficit down, first. Secondly, I think the low-income housing credits, tax credits, should be extended. That's in our tax bill, to give people incentives to build houses in inner cities. The third thing we need to do is to move aggressively in areas where credit is not available to break the credit crunch, and the government's working hard on that. There are all kinds of sectors of our country that have had a huge dry up of credit because of the collapse of the SNLs or because of regional recessions, and we're trying to break that. And finally, we have a Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in Henry Cisneros, the former mayor of San Antonio, Texas, who's got a wonderful raft of ideas about how to go into community after community and set up partnerships in rural and urban areas to get people to build more houses. So that's basically what we're trying to do. The dream of home ownership and, frankly, the importance to the economy are two things that can merge as part of my vision for rebuilding our country from the grassroots up.
President Clinton, we only have a couple more minutes before we take another break. Another quick question for you from over here. Please stand.
I'm Joanne Schwartz. I'm a finance manager from San Jose, California. And my perception is that your administration's a little infatuated with Hollywood and celebrities. Is this a valid observation?
No. You know, of all the national politicians, you know, I never did all these politicians from here run out to Hollywood and have fundraisers all the time. You know how many fundraisers I had there before I ran for president? Zero. We've had two meetings here in the White House where groups of people from Hollywood have wanted to come in and talk about health care and the environment. We've had a couple of people from California who have stayed in the governor's mansion. When my preacher from Arkansas stayed here, nobody wrote it up. When the guy who ran my campaign in Florida stayed here last week, nobody wrote it up. It's another thing where a little thing becomes big because it makes a good story. Doesn't amount to a hill of beans. There are some people in Hollywood who help me, who care about the country. I treat them like I do everybody else that was part of the campaign, want to be part of it. But that is absolutely not true. It's not true now, it's not going to be true, and it's never been true. I like to go to the movies and listen to music. Most of you do too. And that's about the extent of it.
Well, are you concerned, though, that when these little stories that you say just simply
absolutely,
blow up?
Absolutely.
Let me just ask you this, that people who voted for you in the election bought into this image of the man from hope, and that this maybe stories like the $200 haircut with a guy who has one name might increase their cynicism about what's
sure
going
does.
On
sure
in
it
your
does,
administration.
Which is one reason they're so overplayed. But that doesn't mean they're valid. What I keep telling everybody here is we have to realize when you're president, you're a long way from most people in America. And so little things become big. So you have to bend over backwards not to do things that you'd never even give a second thought to if you were a private citizen or a governor or a senator, because they're going to be taken and blown all out of proportion and your whole image is going to be gnarled by it. So we have to be super sensitive not to do things that we would ordinarily do and not give a second thought about it because of the way it will be perceived in the country. That's absolutely right. And we haven't been very smart about that on a couple of these occasions. But that
Whose
doesn't
fault
mean
was that?
It means that we have underestimated the fact that the press will play these things big and people will draw those conclusions from it. But she asked me a substantive question, not an image question. She said, has the administration gone Hollywood? The answer to that is no. Heck no. Never no. Never. Never. That's a substantive answer.
I think the answer is no.
We've got lots more to come live from the White House Rose Garden with President Clinton. We've got questions about defense cuts and what happens to the people who are going to lose their jobs as the defense gets cut. And we're going to come back and get answers to those questions in just a minute. It's 23 minutes after the hour.
Welcome back to CBS This Morning and our special two-hour meeting with President Clinton. We just had to go into a break and we were talking about the notion of entitlements from this man back here. And his essential question was, with entitlements representing about at least 50% of our budget, when is the government going to get serious about cutting into these programs? Did I paraphrase that correctly?
We have, in this budget package that I have presented to Congress, we have about $100 billion in cuts in various entitlement programs over the next 5 years, in Medicare, in agriculture, in veterans programs. But they're still going up very rapidly. The only way ultimately to get control of the entitlements is to control overall health costs and bring them in line with inflation. Now, I could, for example, we could cut health care costs even more, but here's what would happen. If you cut Medicare and Medicaid and you cut what the providers get, the doctors and the hospitals, what do? They shift their cost off to you in the private sector. That's been happening for years now. People who have no health insurance get health care in this country. People whose health care is underfunded get health care anyway, and the cost gets shifted on to private employers and their employees in the form of exploding health insurance premiums. So health care costs in the private sector as a whole are going up as fast or faster than health care costs in the government sector. And the trick is how to get them under control without messing up the programs like the gentleman over here who's got a good program that where they have control of their own costs. That's the trick. But you got to deal with the private and the public to do that.
We have a question here, sir. What's your name?
Ted Narc from Bellevue, Washington.
Your question?
The aerospace community is being assailed by the Europeans on the commercial side. And in some respects, the defense budget will assail them on the defense budget side. Combination of those two are making the aerospace employment a very delicate issue. A lot of unemployment, a lot of people without jobs. How do you think the new defense budget will address that as part of their program?
First of all, I want to answer your question, but I want to make a point since you stood up here, and I appreciate it. There are budget cuts and budget cuts. Everybody knows we have to bring the defense budget down, and we have cut it a lot. We are right on the edge. We should not cut it more right now. I feel very strongly about that. A lot of the defense cuts are in areas of contracts where people work in America. The question is, what are they going to do when you lay them off? Why is Southern California in so much trouble? Largely because of all the defense cuts with no plans to find anything else. We believe very strongly in this administration, and I personally believe, based on my experience as a governor trying to put people back to work, that a portion of the defense cuts should be devoted to three things. One, retraining workers if they need retraining. Two, helping companies to develop domestic markets to make up for the defense contracts they lost. And three, helping communities that have been devastated to restructure their economies. In the aerospace industry, I am convinced that the real key there is to try to have a competitive airline industry in America that's healthy and try to make sure the airline manufacturers, the airplane manufacturers and the parts manufacturers have access to markets at home and abroad. The Commerce Secretary, Ron Brown, has just been around the world doing what he can to open up more markets for aerospace commercially. We cannot afford to lose our world leadership there just because we're cutting back in defense. Aerospace is one of seven areas of technology that will produce most of the high-wage, high-growth jobs for the world in the next 20 years, and we've got to try to maintain our leadership. I just appointed a commission, along with the Congress, bipartisan, completely bipartisan on this issue, to look at ways to revitalize aerospace. And I think we're going to make some progress.
Okay, got another quick question before we jump into the break here.
Mr. President, my name is Bill Roberts. I'm the senior pastor of Christ Chapel in Woodbridge, Virginia. And I would like to say that we in the Woodbridge area pray for you and your administration regularly and daily.
Thank you.
Allow me to ask the question, give you 2 minutes and 2 hours and 31 minutes to talk about the issue of gays in the military, if I may. I'm concerned about the degradation of morality in our nation, in our society, in the military as a whole. And I'm concerned with the long-term consequences of actions, not only in the issue with gays in the military, but also with actions associated with health care in terms of the funding of abortion, issues such as that. The Christian community is very concerned in this nation about those issues, and I'm just somewhat disturbed, particularly about the policy process for developing those programs.
Let me answer the, let's just talk about the gays in the military, because we don't have a lot of time to go into all of it. First of all, I think the military has a great moral fabric. I don't think you can over, just because we know there are homosexuals in the military and always have been. We know that the Tailhook scandal occurred. I don't think Tailhook reflects on the whole Navy. I think that the military has done more to give people a good, coherent set of values and a way to live and succeed in a very complicated and disintegrating world than most of the institutions in this country have. So I think that you should not worry about that. Here is the issue. There are, and always have been, homosexuals in the military. The question is whether they should be kicked out, not because of what they do, but because of who they are. My view is people should be judged on their conduct. I have not called for any change in the Uniform Code of Conduct. I simply believe if people work hard, play by the rules, and serve, they ought to be able to serve. That does not imply that the rest of the society agrees with the lifestyle, but you just accept as a fact that there are in every country, and always have been, homosexuals who are capable of honoring their country, laying down their lives for their country, and serving. And they should be judged based on their behavior, not their lifestyle. That's my view, their behavior. It's a behavior test. And I think that the difficulty here, let me say this. Look, we almost have a compromise here. Most Americans believe if you don't ask and you don't say and you're not forced to confront it, people should be able to serve. Most Americans believe that the gay lifestyle should not be promoted by the military or anybody else in this country. The issue is a narrow one. Should you be able to acknowledge, if asked, that you are homosexual? And if you don't do anything wrong, should you be booted from the military? We are trying to work this out so that our country does not, I understand what you're saying, so that our country does not appear to be endorsing a gay lifestyle, but we accept people as people and give them a chance to serve if they play by the rules. I think that is the tough issue for us, and I think we're very close to resolving it here.
Could you be satisfied with don't ask, don't tell, don't investigate? Might that be where you might end up?
Well, we might end up that way as long as it doesn't lead to a whole range of deliberate outings. You know what I mean? We don't want to make it worse. I think we're very close to a compromise along those lines. And I think most Americans will agree when it works out that people are treated properly if they behave properly without the government appearing to endorse a lifestyle. I think that's what you're concerned about, and it's a legitimate concern. But I have to deal with people as people, and I've had so many people in the military come up to me and said that they have served with homosexuals who served bravely in Vietnam and other places who were good people who did not violate any rules. It is them that I am trying to protect.
President Clinton, thank you very much. We'll take a short break here and be back in just a couple of minutes. Lots more to come on CBS This Morning.
President, who are you?
Mr. President, my name is John Blair, and I'm from San Angelo, Texas. One quick question on the health care issue. We know it does not yet appear what the health care plan is going to look like, but will we be ensured that we know that the less fortunate of this country and the unemployed will have ready access to quality care?
Yes. But it's not just the people who don't have health insurance. The people who have it who are afraid of losing it because somebody in their family's been sick and they can't change jobs. There are millions of Americans locked into their jobs today because there's someone in their family has a pre-existing condition. We need to change the rules so that you can change jobs and you can be unemployed and your business can fail and you don't have to worry about getting health care. I think it's very important. And if we do it right, we can do it and hold down the cost of health care, not drive it up. Keep in mind, your country spends 35% more than any other country on earth on health care, more of our income. We can do this.
Question all the way in the back. What's your name?
Jennifer. I'm from Northridge, California, and I've been visiting Washington, D.C., and I've noticed a lot of homeless people on the streets, and it really made me sad and everything, and I was just wondering if you had any plans to help them find jobs and get homes.
We do, actually. I have the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Mr. Cisneros, has just established a commission on homelessness, and they're supposed to give him a report in September about what we can do to change this. It's a very complicated problem. We're now having some people who don't want to go into the shelters at night because they don't think they'll be safe, and they think they're safer on the streets. It's a very sad thing. It's a question of jobs, of education, of drug treatment often, but we need to do something. I run by every day when I run out here. I run by about six homeless people who stop and say, hello, Mr. President, and I talk to them, and I look at them and think, you know, I ought to be able to get those people off the street. If I can do anything, I ought to be able to do that. And we're going to try.
I think we only got 30 seconds left. Let's see if we can accomplish this. Fire away.
Hello, Mr. President. My name is Christopher Walker. I'm from DeKalb, Illinois. I'd like to get back earlier to what we were discussing. You were talking about how you were filtered to the media. And is there a problem with how you're filtered from the administration's point of view and your administration? Or is it something with a focus on too many issues at once? Okay. And not a specific drive.
Well, we're really not going to give you much time. 15 seconds, Mr. President. Sorry.
I think we should. We have to do more than one thing, but we need to talk about one thing at a time. There's a difference in we have to. You can't just shut the whole thing down. If we want to have welfare reform and student loans done 8 months from now, we have to start doing them now. But we need to talk about one thing. That's my passion.
We're back,
in life, you know.
Live in the Rose Garden at the White House with President Clinton. Did you vote for President Clinton?
Yes, I did.
And have you been worried about him a little bit?
Yes, I have been.
And what?
So is my mother. I'm glad you.
Hey, I'm old enough to be his mother, but I'm the wrong gender. No, I was concerned, but frankly, since being here this morning, I'm reinforced that in my hopes and belief that you'll do a good job. I really am. I think you're on the right track. You've given me a lot more confidence. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I actually have one question about Chelsea here, but before we get there, before we go off the air, I just wanted to, if you could give us a little more information on health care this morning. We know that some of your economic advisors have been advising against going with the big bang theory of doing this health care reform all at once. What exactly are their fears? What are they worried about, and are those fears warranted?
Well, they're afraid that we won't be able to get savings out of the system. Let me just say, basically, to go back to this man's question here on the health care issue, you look at America compared to other countries, we spend more on insurance and paperwork, government regulation, and other things than any other country does. What our attempt is going to be is to get savings out of all that and use that to cover the uninsured and to make it cheaper for farmers, for small business people, and for self-employed people to get insurance. That's the deal. Some of them are afraid we can't get the savings quick enough, so they say we ought to have just a major medical coverage and protect people from disaster. But if you look at the economics are a disaster. If you have a $3,000 deductible or something like that, well, what have you got? You don't have much. That's what a lot of people have today. So what I want to do is to phase in the coverage, but when you give it to people, give them something that's worth having, that really gives family security. I'd rather phase it. I think the American people would rather us phase it in and do it gradually and do it right and then give people something that's worth something than do it overnight but give them something that's not worth a nickel.
Can we talk about a family member now?
Yeah. Hi, my name's Nathaniel Musson. I'm a freshman in high school. My question was, some time ago you said that our schools are safe, and if so, how come you won't let Chelsea go to a public school?
Well, I didn't say our schools are safe. I said they could be. But that's not, the question of personal safety had nothing to do with it. My daughter was always in a public school, and her public school education is serving her quite well now. She's doing well in the school she's in. She and her mother and I reviewed all the possible schools we could send her to, and we looked at three private schools and three public schools. We examined it, we thought a lot about it. We decided that this was best for her for a number of reasons. One is, my daughter is not a public figure. She does not want to be a public figure. She does not like getting a lot of publicity. And frankly, she has more privacy and more control over her destiny where she is than she would if she were at the public school that she was also interested in attending. And we all three of us made a family decision that it would be best for her under these circumstances. I also think the school that she decided to attend, has some very special things about it, including a requirement that children do community service. There's a whole approach that the friends have to the education system that she was interested in exploring. But it was not a rejection of the public schools. It was a decision that because of who she is and where she is and the circumstance she's in, she would be happier and a little more, she'd feel that she could be more of a normal kid if she could do that. That's the only reason we did it. We didn't reject the public schools.
A little bit less than a minute right here, and a real important question, Mr. President.
Hi, I'm Jared Delaney from Marietta, Georgia. I'm going to ask you the question that President Kennedy admonished us all to ask 33 years ago. What can we do to help our country?
And the clock is running. 30 seconds.
You can do what you're doing today. You can keep asking us questions and keep saying to people, put aside the partisan politics and try to solve the problems of the country. Get something done. You're going to make mistakes if you try to do something, but move us forward. The second thing you can do is to let everybody know that you're willing to do your part if everybody else does theirs, if it's fair. The third thing you can do is to go back home and ask, what problem do we have in this community that Bill Clinton can't do anything about? Except maybe set an example and try to deal with some of these, the family problems we've got, the children's problems we've got, a lot of the value problems we've got. They have to be dealt with one-on-one from the grassroots up. And every American needs to be involved in community service like that, that the government cannot solve some of these problems. And if we did more at the local level, our government would function better.
We're going to wrap things up in the White House when we come back.
Arkansas, the state where the people rule.
And you don't think he'll get extra credit for getting it signed by the president?
Yay. This wraps up our special two-hour edition of CBS This Morning, our town meeting with President Clinton. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Mr. Reagan. Appreciate it.
Will you ever invite us back into the Rose Garden here?
Absolutely. All right. I'd like for all of them to come back.